Right, so this concluding section to this sermon. I don't know how many of you, if you're preparing a sermon or you've heard something, would finish a sermon quite like that. It's not what you might call the classic ending to a sermon. But it does actually, we are often in this artificial kind of situation where we look at a portion of scripture on its own, and not necessarily in the context of the whole flow. And you've got to remember, this is the end of the sermon. There's been a lot that's been going on before this point. And the relevance of it is partly bound up in what has gone on before. So I'm going to try and use an illustration here, quite a graphic illustration here, to try and at least put you in mind of what it might have been like standing there listening to this sermon being preached. I'm trying to give you an illustration here of what it might have been like to hear this sermon being preached. So I want you to imagine that a special church meeting has been called, and every member has been summoned together to arrive at the church, and nobody knows what the agenda is going to be. It's an unusual meeting. It's not an ordinary meeting. And at the course of that meeting, the pastor stands up and says, "I have something important that I need to tell you all." And during the course of his address, he begins to look back over the years that you've spent together, the work that you've done together, the challenges that you've faced, the problems you've had to overcome, and all the different aspects of your life and service in former years. And then, as if out of the blue, without any apparent warning, the pastor discloses to the congregation that he has committed a disqualifying sin. And consequent to that, it's beholden upon him to withdraw from his position as pastor of the church. So you can imagine the atmosphere of a meeting like that. So the last part of his address then goes on to deal with some of the questions that this event has raised in their hearts and in their minds. Who's going to lead us into the future? Dealing with their sense of loss of somebody that they love and have walked with and they won't be able to be walking with in the future. Concerns about their future. Now, if you can grasp that situation, if you can kind of pick up on that situation, that in essence is what this sermon was what was happening in the course of this sermon. Moses stands up before all the people, the whole assembly of Israel, and he looks back over the past times. And we all know our Bible well enough, don't we, to know that Moses committed this sin in the wilderness, which was completely secret, and he doesn't disclose it to Israel until this point. This is the first they've heard about it, that he has struck the rock twice, that God has forbidden him from entering into the promised land. And there, as they are standing on the brink of the promised land, he is confiding in them that something has happened which means that he is not going to be able to go with them in the coming days. Can you imagine that this might be a bit of a shock? A bit of a shock. That right at the heart of this sermon, chapter 3, the heart of the sermon, the sort of latter part from verse 23 onwards, which is at the very heart, it's like he's been working up to this, to telling them this thing. Going back over the past, looking at former things, and coming to this painful and difficult confession to make. And he tells them at the center of it what he has done and what the consequences are going to be, not just for him, but for them all. And the last part of the sermon, the application, the practical application of it, is very much hinged on what life in their congregation is going to be like without the person who has pastored them and been the very voice of God amongst them. So perhaps that puts some context into what we're looking at tonight. So the passage we've read here at the end, from verse 41 on, the cities of refuge and this kind of reiteration, this is the law that Moses set before us, etc., is connected to everything that we have just said. We have got a congregation that are very, very uncomfortable. Can you see that this is preaching to a very discomforted congregation, a very unsettled congregation, and the substance of this message is the preaching of comfort to the uncomfortable. They're having to deal with a piece of news, a shocking piece of news. And he's reassuring them through his preaching, because God has been dealing with him privately, so he's able to share with them publicly. If you're like me, there are times when you need comfort from God. Things happen, they shock you, they surprise you, you're thrown out of your comfort zone, and you find yourself either resorting to your own solutions, which can be quite detrimental, can't it? Or you come to God. You come to God and you listen to God. What does God have to say to me in a time and a place like this? And that's what we're dealing with here. Do you find that the Bible, the structure of the Bible is a bit puzzling at times? You read through something, you think, what is that doing there? Why at the end of this have we suddenly got this whole thing about the cities of refuge? What has this got to do with that? Do you ever find yourself asking those sort of questions? So we've just been hearing, I think last week, those of you here last week, that from verse 32 of chapter 4 onwards, I preached to you about the substance of that section there, which is about the oneness of God, the greatness of God, the incomparable greatness of God, and the uniqueness of God. Why, straight after saying all these great and glorious things about God, do we make this transition suddenly to the appointing of three cities as places of refuge, and then this kind of tidy up and reiteration of things at the end? How is all this working? Well, I think to get some purchase on this, we have to realize that the way this is written, the way it's spoken, is different to the way that people write and speak today. And it's got its own logic to it, and it's got its own grammar to it. This is, please remember, was written 3,500 years ago in a country very different to our own. And the way people communicate and speak is very different to our own. The Bible speaks today. I trust you find the Bible speaks today. But we do also have to remember that this was written during the 18th Egyptian dynasty, sort of back that period. Moses has been educated in Egyptian 18th dynasty universities and stuff like that, which is a very different world to the world that we live in today in a lot of ways. And what's been written here, the words that are being used, we don't have any examples of the original text. But it was almost certainly written in what is called I'm not going to bore you with all of this, but proto-Sinaitic alphabet, which is the earliest alphabet in existence in the world. It was very, very crude, very, very simple alphabet. And so one of the things that you don't have, and there's no function for this time in history, there's no punctuation. They didn't have punctuation in those days. They didn't have capital letters and full stops and exclamation marks and all the things. But before this, they'd been all written in hieroglyphs and so on. And now they're having to find a way to put ideas together, put ideas before people, so people know when's the beginning and when's the end, and putting some structure into what they write. And what I want to share with you is perhaps you've heard about this before, is something called an inclusio. Does that mean anything to anybody? An inclusio, does that mean anything? So it works like a bookend. It works like a bookend. You open something with a statement, and then you know that that statement is concluded by you say something that refers to what you said at the beginning. So you know that I'm repeating something I started with, I'm repeating it at the end, because it's like I'm closing off that idea by this repetition. Do you see what I'm saying? What we have here in this passage here is an inclusio. If you look with me at the beginning of the sermon, you'll see that at the beginning of the sermon, in the first chapter, we have these reference to these various places within the Jordan area. And then verse 4 onwards, you see there's Og, king of Bashan, and various people that are mentioned there. Can you see it there in the opening chapter? And then at the end of the book, which we've been looking at tonight, from verse 44 of chapter 4 onwards, you can see these same places being referred to again, and the same people being referred to again. There's Og, king of Bashan again, and there's Zion, king of the Amorites, and this particular part of the Jordan Valley, this all the geographical details. So by starting it off with these words and this structure of words, he then comes back to the very same things that he started with at the beginning, and he revisits them, and it kind of closes things off. It's like a bookend at the end of what he started. I hope that I've made that reasonably clear. I don't know what you see here, but you see in my Bible it says introduction to the law in big black letters. Do you see above verse 44 of chapter 4? It says an introduction to the law, as if that's the beginning of something. Yes? I honestly believe that's a mistake. That is not the beginning of something. That's the end of something. He's reiterated what he said before. This is the law that I'm preaching to you. It says at the beginning. And then at the end, it's basically like saying, and this was the law that you've now heard. Now you've heard it. I'm going to say it, and now I've said it. And that's how you know that he's winding down from what he's been speaking about, because he's repeating what he started with, and he's closing it off. You can see it as well as further bit of evidence. There will be a point to this in a minute. Chapter 1, verse 1, you can see these are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel beyond the Jordan in the wilderness. You can see that at the beginning of the sermon, it's introduced with this expression. These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel. And then if you go over in chapter 5, which is which is outside of this sermon, I would say, and the beginning of the next sermon, you see the same expression. And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel." So in both occasions, at the beginning of that and then the beginning of chapter 5, you have this sense of people being gathered together in order to hear what God would say to them. So that's a marker telling us where it is a beginning, and so the end is not, chapter 44 is not the end. I hope I've kind of got that across. So why are these cities of refuge and this reiteration of the law, again, of what they've heard before, why is all this closing off the end of this? What's the significance of it? Because it doesn't just serve as grammar, right? That would be not enough to really say tonight, would it? I want to try and show that. I've never been to war, and I hope I never have to. I don't know if any of us have been to war, but I hope we never have to. But these people who he's speaking to, who he's had to tell these very difficult things to, are about to fight for their lives. These people, if you want to make an analogy, these people are like those assembling down in Devon in advance of the D-Day landings. Everybody's gathering together. There's just this imminent sense that any day now, very, very soon, their whole lives, which have been basically lived pretty much as civilian lives in many, many respects, are going to change dramatically, and they're going to go into battle. So he has got to preach a message to these people who are about to fight for their lives, and very many of them, no doubt, are going to die. They're at that critical point where life and death is right on their doorsteps. And he has to tell them, not only is he sending them to go and fight for their lives, but he's also telling them that he himself is not going to be going with them. It's a very difficult sermon to preach, to encourage people to take their lives in their hands and know that you are sending them, but you're not coming with them. Can you see what the great danger at this time would be of just telling them this piece of information and not being able to do it in the right way? Can you see what the consequences would be? It would break your morale, wouldn't it? We should call this whole thing off. We need to call a special meeting. We need to get a committee together, because, to be honest with you, now we've got this great big problem that we haven't got a leader anymore. We've got to shut the whole thing down, and they're going to pull back. In other words, the invasion will be put off just because he is not going with them. But he's got to tell them. He's got to tell them. Chapter 3, verse 26. The fact is, as soon as the invasion starts, if he's not there, he will be missed. So at some point, he has to tell them what is going on. What a body blow. What an absolute body blow to people who are getting ready, ramped up and ready to do something for the Lord, only to find the spiritual leader, the person who's been there to encourage them and guide them and strengthen them, has failed them and is pulling out. I know some of you have had experiences where people you've looked up to, people you've respected, people you've come to depend on have let you down. Have you ever had those experiences where you think this person is going to be with you and you've looked up to them, you've almost perhaps put them on a pedestal, and then suddenly there's this painful moment when you realize they've got feet of clay, that they're not able to help you as you thought you would they would be able to. They're not going to be able to be there when you need them. They're not going to be standing by you as you would hope. That's the kind of situation that these people are in as Moses is preaching to them. As he preaches to them, their discomfort increases. Can you see that? Their morale is sinking as he speaks. What's going to happen? How's this going to be dealt with? When they're all these disappointed expectations. In one sense, I'm going to be all right because you are with me. You're going to be there. You're going to be leading your talents, your gifts, your abilities. And now suddenly, they're not going to be there. It's just going to be me. I'm going to be on the front line. It's a challenging situation for them to all be in. And soldiers, we know from the post-traumatic stress disorder that so many of them have suffered in consequence of conflict, what a stressful experience conflict is. And people prepare themselves for this in a very rigorous sort of way. This is not the time for preaching bad news, for bringing bad news. So, at least we can see this in the preceding chapters from verse 32 when he's speaking about the oneness of God, the uniqueness of God, the greatness of God, the incomparable greatness of God. At least in the light of all of that, we can see he's addressing this need, their need of morale, somebody to turn to, somebody to look to, somebody who will lead them, somebody who will guide them, because they are facing significant discouragement. Somebody said, low morale leads to low morals. How many times do people who make bad decisions, really bad decisions, make them at a time when they are in a discouraged state, when they're a low state? And Moses is most concerned to make sure that they don't make a catastrophic mistake at this time. Because discouragement is not just a bad feeling, is it? Discouragement can lead people to make bad choices. Have you seen that happen? You've seen people who get out of the spirit, they get discouraged, and they do something that they have to live with for some considerable time, and you can talk to them, but because they're in that state of discouragement, it's like they can't hear and they won't listen. This is a really dangerous situation. In substance, what he's been saying to them is that real leadership has always and ever come from God. That he's only ever been the mouthpiece. He's only ever been there as a kind of figurehead. It's God. God is the one who's done the miracles. It's God that's supreme above all things. And whether he's there or not there, God is still God. And that, in terms of their morale, is absolutely crucial, isn't it? To know whether the people you depend on, the people you love, the people you trust, whether they're there or not, God is there. And he is the great leader. He is the great shepherd of the sheep. And that is what he's trying to address to their hearts. After all the things they've had to adapt and take on board, he's bringing them back to God so they know who it is that's going to lead them. So I think one of the things that we've been saying in this sermon up until now is just trust in the Lord. He will direct your path, if you can take it like that. When you've been let down, when you're disappointed, when you're discouraged, trust in the Lord. So moving on from that, the whole burden of the people's journey, all their focus has been on crossing over the Jordan. They're very goal-driven at this time, highly focused and very goal-orientated at this time. And at times like that, people get very, very brittle. I know people love to take pop shots at football players, the way they dive and tumble on the football pitch. And maybe you've looked at them and thought, you know, what is going on there? But the truth is, when you're running as fast as they're running, and when you're in that state of fitness and training as they are, a little knock or a push can send them flying a lot further than most of us that are just kind of plodding about. In fairness, we don't get affected because we're not as invested as they are. Here, we see people who are deeply invested into a situation, and one little knock could absolutely derail the whole process. Moses is not going to cross over, but they are still going to have to cross over. And here's the second thing that they're going to have to deal with. Because it's not just they're going to miss his leadership. They're not just going to miss his ministry. They're going to miss him. He will not be with them. I remember one time just watching two lads playing badminton together. And every time one of them played a good shot, they looked up into the gallery where their dad was watching the game. And every time they did something, they just looked up. It's just only for an instant, just to have that eye on them, to know that they're being watched, to know they could the things that they're doing, the things that he's perhaps encouraged them to or taught them to do, they're now doing. These people have been spent their whole lives under Moses' ministry. And it's not just his leadership, it's not just his capacities there, it's just his presence, that sense of somebody to look to, somebody you care about, you've come to admire and respect. And when they go into battle, when they win their victories, when they scale the walls, whenever they're out there, they're going to look round and he's not going to be there. Have you ever been invited to a party and you've agreed there's two of you going to go to a party and your friend says, I can't go tonight. And you say to yourself, I don't want to go then. Because you're going to miss them. You're just going to miss them. And one of the things that they're facing here is they're going to feel exposed and alone without the presence of the person who's just been such a stable and constant presence in their life. It's really, really bad for morale, isn't it? How many people have we talked to who have suffered a loss in some one shape or form? And they end up being angry with God. And they say, God has taken this person from me, this person I love, this person I need. This is no time for being angry with God. This is a time for trust, as we've just said. And that, again, is why Moses, in his preaching, he's emphasizing to them, by way of comfort, to deal with the issue of their morale, their collapsing morale, in chapter 4, verse 31, that he will never leave you or destroy you or forget the covenant. Not only is God going to lead them in the coming days, whether he's there or not, he will be with them. When you're doing the X and the Y and the Z in the battlefield and you're looking around for me, don't look for me. Look for him. Look for God. He is with you. And that is the most important thing of all. And that's the second great reminder, I think, that he's preaching through the course of this sermon. As Jesus said to us, I will be with you always, even to the end of the world. You ever felt alone? You ever felt a bit bereft? I will be with you, even to the end of the world. What great comfort that is to know that God is with you. And God is leading you. So he's preaching, isn't it, to their hearts. To their hearts. They're facing discouragement. They're facing difficulties. But he's pointing them to God as their comfort, their lead, their strength. He's very concerned about their morale. But let's come to this last section, because I haven't really dealt with it so much, have I? The truth is that Moses is going to die. And Moses is going to die on the east side of the Jordan. He is going to die outside of the promised land. And the significance of that in their minds must be pretty huge. You see, to die outside of the land is to die alongside all those people who've disobeyed the Lord in past times. There's that verse, isn't there, in Hebrews where it says, and the wilderness was littered with their bodies. There were the scattered bodies of the disobedient on the east side of the Jordan. And Moses, that is Moses' end. That's the judgment of God on Moses. He is not going to die in the promised land, the land of glory. That's where they all, if I'm going to live, I'm going to die, that's where I want to die. I want to die there if I'm going to die anywhere at all. But him, he's going to be, it's crushing, isn't it? It's crushing to their morale. You know, we might accept that the God's judgment on Moses is just. He has sinned. This is his judgment. Moses accepts it. I've talked to countless people who struggle with this issue of God's dealing with Moses at this time and at this place. Because in some way, shape, or form, people feel that he's been less than merciful towards Moses. Considering all that Moses has done, It just seems less than merciful. And Moses has just been preaching to them, chapter 4, verse 31, that the Lord your God is a merciful God. How is it, if he is so merciful, and that he will never leave us, and he'll never destroy us, that you yourself, who is the greatest amongst us, you yourself are not going to be able to obtain mercy, you're going to die in the wilderness with all the others. See, I imagine in their minds, they're thinking, if I could serve God half as faithfully as him, and God is dealing with him so severely, what hope have we got? What hope have we got? If we put a foot wrong, what's going to happen to us? And that's no way to serve, is it? It's a very harsh regime. If you feel, if you put one foot wrong, it's like a ton of bricks are going to come down on your head. You've got to feel that there's mercy and grace, that you're appreciated and forgiven and helped along on the way. And yet it's very clear that this man is not going into the promised land. It's not good for morale, is it? That you're dealing with the God who's leading you, the God who's going to be with you, is not perhaps a merciful God at all. How can you deal with all these blows to their morale? God will lead them. God will be with them. But there's still this question, what is going to become of Moses? The destiny, God's dealings with Moses. Is God really merciful? Can I trust him with my life? Do I want him to be with me if this is the way he deals with his servants? But the closing lines here, which we're coming to, tells that it's very clear they have to, that Moses has to stay and they have to go. And he refers back to the things that they heard at the beginning of the sermon. It's difficult, isn't it? You hear something at the beginning of a sermon, and then maybe something comes up in the midst of it, and you forget what was there at the beginning, and he's restating it all again at the end. He reminds them again where they are. They're in this place called Bashan on the eastern side in the Arabah, and these former lands that belonged to Amorite kings. So after all the shocking news that he's not going with them, he reminds them, as he did at the beginning, that they have already been victorious. And the land in which they stand at that particular moment, which was never given to them before as part of the land of promise, it's not part of the promised land. Nevertheless, it is now in their possession. It is now in their possession. Now, it came to their possession because of a judgment on those kings, not because of the initial promise. Og and Sihon had given up their rights to the land because they wouldn't make a peaceful alliance with the Israelites as they came through. It could have been different. And if you remember the tribes of Reuben and Gad, who are mentioned in this section here, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had asked that this land could belong to them after they've conquered the promised land. They weren't allowed to enter it at the beginning, but they had to go into the promised land, fight their battles, and then they could have it as their reward at the end. And this is where the significance of these three cities comes in. From the moment that Moses declares that there are going to be three cities of refuge in this part of the land, which is on the eastern side of the Jordan, he's effectively declaring that the law of Moses under which they will live, the law on which the whole land of promise is going to be ruled by, is also going to apply to this side of the Jordan too. These cities of refuge were given really for the promised land. The moment he says we're also going to build cities of refuge on this side of the river, he is saying the same law and the same Lord is going to rule over this side of the river as rules on the side of the river that you are now going to conquer. And it's not an accident either that he declares that these cities are going to be places where sinners, people who failed, people who've fallen short, will be able to find the mercy of God. People like him, people who've fallen short, will be able to find mercy, not in the land of promise, but on the eastern side of the river, on the other side too. In short, Moses may not be going over the river with them into the promised land, but the promised land, if you will, is coming over the river to be where Moses is. That God's mercy is extending, is not just restrained to that place, but God's mercy can be found there too. And all these references to the geography establishes these markers. He's saying, where I am, it's not the promised land, but this is where God has put me. And God can reach me and deal with me here. And God will be with you and deal with you there. We may be separated, but you go and do God's will, and I'll do God's will, and we will all know the mercy of God wherever we are. In short, Moses, in that sense, dies in holy land, in holy land. They're going to go. God is going to be with them, and God will lead them. But God will also be staying and remaining and abiding with Moses on the other side of the river too. You see, the third point really is that we can cast all our cares on him because he does care for us. Even in his anger, he remembers mercy. Moses has given up things that he would dearly love, but he hasn't lost his relationship with God. He may have failed, he may have sinned, he may have fallen short, he may have disappointed people, but God is still his God and will never leave him or forsake him either. I was just thinking about the situation of Moses dying on the East Bank. And in a way, it's a bit like Jesus dying on the cross. To many people, it would have seemed a shameful thing to die on the East Bank. Just like Christ's death on the cross appears to be a shameful thing. What a shameful way to end such a tremendous ministry, such an ignominious end. But that's what happened to Jesus. And that's what happened to Moses. Moses has told them in chapter 3, verse 26, that the reason he's staying is for their sake. It's on their account, and it's for their sake that he's staying behind. And it reminds me that Jesus, not also when he died that ignominious death, also did it for our sake. They're both doing God's will. It may be hard to swallow, it may be difficult to accept, but it is God's will that's being done. One of them is accepting Moses, is accepting he's a sinner. It's the will of God that he should declare that he's a sinner and be open about it. The other one is dying a sinner's death. But both of them, though they are experiencing shame in the outward sense, they are glorifying God in their obedience, both of them. Moses must have found this a hard sermon to preach, to tell the congregation that he'd sinned, that he was leaving office. But ultimately, he's telling them, it's okay. It's okay. They not only must go on, they can go on because God is with them. God will lead them and God will be with him also. They needn't worry. It makes me think of what's recorded in John's Gospel, chapter 16 and verse 7, which is Jesus speaking. Nevertheless, I tell you the truth, it's to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Helper will not come to you. Perhaps in the providence of God, the people have been weaned off their dependence on Moses and weaned onto God, their Helper, to lead them into the coming days. In a strange sense, Moses' death on the East Bank sanctifies the East Bank. And Jesus' death sanctifies even a place like Calvary. Who would have thought that a cross would ever be a symbol of anything good, anything wonderful. But through Christ's death there, his obedience there, even the dark things suddenly have been filled with light. Sometimes people can't come with us. People can't be with us. But if the reason they can't do it is because they have to do God's will, then it's okay, isn't it? We all have to do God's will as he reveals to each and every one of us. And in this situation, even grief can be holy. Well, we know that after this, later, the Israelites would go over the border. The Reubenites would go with them, the Gadites and the Manassites. And when they came back to take the land which had been promised to them, it wasn't just a secondary place, an annex. It was holy land they were coming back to. They became the custodians of Moses' burial place. As something to go back to, isn't it? Not a second-class place, but that's the place which God, in his providence and mercy, ultimately blesses. I want us to sing something tonight. I want to sing 5-4-3, which is Onward Christian Soldiers. all sorts of things happen, don't they? All sorts of things happen in the Christian life, in our Christian progress. All sorts of experiences. People at times face real discouragements. But knowing God as our Lord, knowing that God is dealing with each and every person in whatever state they're in, knowing that we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, but knowing that if we are truly repentant and obedient to his will, we can find wherever we are his blessing and his peace and his mercy and his strength for what we have to do. 543 onward Christian soldiers marching us to war with the cross of Jesus going on before.
Soldiers marching as to war with the cross of Jesus marching on before.
Christ the Royal.